KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on a journalist whose work and coverage of technology issues I've been following for several years and which I have admired greatly, Mike Masnick, founder and journalist at the technology news website TechDirt. TechDirt, for those of you that aren't familiar, is one of the go-to websites to find out what's happening on a variety of issues involving technology, intellectual property, privacy, innovation, and so forth. And Mike's coverage of these issues is both very thorough and also very pointed. You're not going to find much in the way of pulled punches in the coverage, but you're also going to find coverage that, while it is very clear and very direct and offers a very direct perspective, is also balanced and gives many opportunities for the targets, if you will, of concern in the articles to respond and also to discuss the issues in detail. TechDirt at TechDirt.com is one of the sites that I use regularly in my own research and writing, but is one that is widely respected for covering these issues, for being on the ground and on top of these issues really since its inception, and continues to remain highly relevant as we go through a variety of issues, which we're going to be discussing today, from how IP law, intellectual property law, is made in 2012, both at the international and at domestic level, to what is the role of entities like the FCC and others in creating rules, to how does the entertainment industry address these issues. And so Mike's work, like I said, is one that I rely upon, that many other scholars and practitioners and policymakers in the field rely upon, and one that I check every morning as I get ready to focus my day on the internet and IP issues that I focus on in my own professional work. Mike's background is one that also is near and dear to my heart. He, like me, is a graduate of the Cornell Industrial and Labor Relations School. He graduated in 1997. I graduated in 1994. I did not know Mike at Cornell, as seniors and freshmen rarely interact. I rarely interacted with freshmen. I'm sure others might have different dealings. But at any rate, Mike is both a graduate of the IOR School of Cornell as well as a graduate of the Johnson Business School, where he got his MBA, and is the CEO and founder of TechDirt, and we're going to talk a bit about that as well. So, without any further introduction, because I want to get right into the issues that Mike's covering, I should emphasize that this show is being recorded on July 18th for airing July 24th, and Mike is joining us via Skype from his home in Silicon Valley. Mike, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Sure, thanks for having me. This should be fun.
Let's start off, Mike, with a question I ask most of the people on the show, particularly for those that aren't familiar with TechDirt. If you could talk a bit more about your background and the founding of TechDirt and why you founded it.
Sure. So in some ways it was kind of an accidental thing. I actually started it when I was back at Cornell in the 90s, and I was somewhat interested in eventually getting a job in the technology industry. And as you well know, Cornell is somewhat isolated from everything.
Yeah, right.
So I thought if I were to write about the technology industry in some way or another, then, you know, it would be a good way to get a job after I graduated. And, you know, I was very focused on coming at it from a business perspective, because that's, you know, business and economics perspective, because that's where my academic interests lie. And then just, you know, interested in general as a fan of technology and someone who believes in the importance of, you know, technology helping to make things better in the world and open up new opportunities. And so that was my general thing, was let's just write about innovation and technology from a business and economics perspective. And then it was only after I started doing that the legal and policy issues made themselves clear. the more you write about things relating to technology and innovation, the policy stuff and legal stuff becomes more and more important. And so ended up digging deeper and deeper into that area over the years, and just sort of kept writing it, and you know, after a certain point, turned it into a business and built it up from there. And so, you know, in one form or another, TechDirt is actually about a month away from its 15th anniversary. But as a business, it's been going for almost 12 years.
And so in its initial inception, what was it?
In its very, very initial inception, it was an email newsletter. I started out as a weekly email newsletter, just about kind of quick tidbits on what was happening in the technology industry that I thought was interesting or entertaining in some cases. And then it sort of quickly morphed into a website that I was updating manually, and then became a blog before the word blog existed, about a year after that. So somewhere in around 98 or late 98 or early 99, it actually took on the blog format, even though that word didn't exist.
And so, and if you, when you think about the issues that you cover, what, and jump in there before we talk a little more structurally about tech there, what are your guiding principles in terms of choosing the many topics that, and areas that you cover on TechDirt?
To some extent, I'm not even sure there's necessarily a guiding principle, but I would say that, you know, I'm very interested in innovation in general, and the process of innovation in terms of how innovation can make the world better. It sounds really idealistic and sort of bright-eyed, that is sort of a general interest area of mine. And of course, you know, some people who are very familiar with the site might find that odd, because a lot of people seem to think that I'm angry, because, you know, a lot of the coverage on the site is very, very opinionated and very, you know, pointed, as you indicated. But, you know, what a lot of that is just sort of frustration over, you know, I think the world can be a lot better place, and that we can have a lot more wonderful and important innovations happening that can help the world in a lot of ways. And so what happens is I often get frustrated when I find that those kinds of things hindered or blocked. And so often those are the issues that I'll write about, areas where I think innovation is being held back or blocked in a way that is unfair or unnecessary or you know, harmful overall to general progress, I guess.
So you know, it's interesting you mentioned this perception that people have of you as being angry, and I do want to talk about that a little bit, only because, you know, I like I said, I regularly read TechDirt, and, you know, I certainly detect quite a bit of frustration at what's going on. But as I said, and I certainly wouldn't have invited you on the show if I didn't feel this way. I think you cover the issues in a fair way, even though you have an opinion. But let me ask you this. I mean, how do you balance that role, the classic role of the journalist to get the facts and present the facts, with what is a clear, right, and you don't hide it at all, in fact, you emphasize, position on the issue?
Sure. Well, I mean, a couple of things. One is that, you know, I you know, in all of this, I never came at this and said, I am approaching this as a journalist, first of all. You know, this was something that I was interested in. I wanted to write and write from an opinion standpoint from the very, very beginning. And in some cases, if you look at, you know, if you think about the difference between what is a reporter and maybe what is an opinion columnist, you know, I definitely fall on the opinion columnist side of that scale. Now, you know, but having an opinion and being factually based are not mutually exclusive issues. And in fact, you know, quite the opposite. And so, you know, I have an opinion. In fact, you know, if I don't have an opinion on a particular story or a particular topic, even if it's a big news item, you know, I might not cover it, because, you know, what's the point? Lots of people will cover the factual, you know, ABCs. But, you know, I will only jump in if I have an opinion on something related to it. Now, that said, you know, everything I have is based on my reputation, right? And so if I am getting facts wrong, and there are times when everyone will get, you know, either misled or read something wrong or just, you know, flat out make a mistake. And that happens to me. It happens to just about everyone who writes for a living. You know, that hurts my reputation. And so, you know, there's a social pressure, certainly, to be as factually based as possible and as fair as possible, because, you know, my, you know, I my reputation depends on it, and I try to be that way. And there are certainly people out there who will disagree with your statement that I'm fair.
Right.
There are people who feel that I'm not at all fair, and have no problem expressing that opinion back to me. And you know, that's fine. We can discuss that. But you know, as far as I'm concerned, my entire you know, livelihood and business is based on my reputation, and I take that very seriously. And I certainly try not to do anything that will harm that reputation, such as by, you know, relaying false information or you know, twisting something so out of context that would be considered unfair.
And that, you know, and that gets us, and we're chatting with Mike Mazick of Tech Dirt on July 18th on KZUCF of Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, it gets me into, you know, discussing some of these issues in more detail, but if we think about, you know, or we're discussing, what are hot button issues in technology, as we're recording the show, like I said, on the afternoon of Wednesday the 18th, you've posted, the most recent post is a post, about another potential bill out there that appears to mimic to some degree provisions that came out of the Stop Online Privacy Act or PIPA or other potential bills. And and I think it's emblematic of technology, the body of the article begins with your first sentence: Congress continues to show that it learned absolutely nothing, with absolutely nothing emphasized, from the SOPA PIPA mess earlier this year. And then right above it, you have an update pointing out that perhaps that as you were publishing this, news came that the amendment was rebuffed. But the point, as you say, remains: Congress keeps trying to sneak in little favors to Hollywood every chance it gets. Let me ask you this question, and this really is the focus is more on the nuts and bolts of putting Tech Dirt together. How do you deal with this ever-changing, literally minute-to-minute scenario, particularly because, as you point out, and anyone that reads Tech Dirt knows, you have it in blog format, in the sense that there are continual posts. Those posts are dated and timed. You have updates. You have comments, and the comments are often quite colorful, as you know. How do you deal with that scenario where even, you know, now, and certainly anyone who blogs or writes for a living or is a journalist can appreciate hitting the send button or hitting the publish button or handing in the article and then finding out 2 minutes later that the facts have changed?
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of the nature of publishing today. I mean, I think that, you know, it's certainly not specific just to blogging. In fact, I think that, you know, people who sort of came up in the blogging world tend to be better about dealing with those kinds of things than people came up in the traditional press world, where they were, you know, used to, you know, you file a story, and once you hit the deadline, if the facts change, well, you know, maybe you'll publish an update tomorrow or something. But, you know, all of these stories are fluid, and things happen and things change. And so, you know, I take my responsibility on that part pretty seriously, where if there's an update, you know, we'll update the story. One thing that we really try not to do, and I'm pretty sure we've never done it, is actually take down a story, even in cases where facts have changed completely or where misstated facts were presented, or even, you know, in some cases, very rarely, but occasionally it happens where we got confused about something. You know, we will leave the original story up. We may put a strike through things that have changed and add a detailed update. But, you know, we want to make sure that anyone who's reading it is aware of the process as well, and that, you know, we just express what happens. And oftentimes, you know, we'll discuss it in the comments as well, or note, you know, if there was a change or a response, and you just kind of go from there. If a story is big enough, if something new has happened that's big enough, you know, then we could do another post about it. But if it's just sort of a minor change or a minor update, you know, then it just makes sense to update the story and move on.
Now, you are not a one-man band at Tech Dirt, so perhaps you could tell us about who you work with, both at Tech Dirt and at the parent company.
Sure. So, I mean, we're a relatively small company. We're right now at 7 full-time people, and then we have a number of freelancers who help as well in the writing on the site. And then, you know, the company itself also does additional things. We publish the blog, but we also do research and consulting work. And so, you know, we have some of our staff that's dedicated to that, and you know, we have technology guy and other folks as well. So different people doing different parts of the business at all times. And I tend to be involved in little bits of almost everything that we do. But certainly the blog is a big focus of mine.
Now, last question about Tech Dirt's nuts and bolts, which I'm curious about. Do you have demographic data on who your readership is? And perhaps I'll ask that question in contrast with who you want to be reading Tech Dirt.
We want everybody to
read Tech Dirt. Right, right.
it's the simplest answer. Yeah, I mean, we have some data, and we've done some surveys, and what's interesting is sometimes the data seems to conflict. So, we're always a little skeptical about believing any particular data source in terms of who our readership is, especially, the readership has grown over the years, and certainly over the last year it grew significantly, in large part, I think, to, we sort of became one of the central news sources about the SOPA-PIPA fight, and so that certainly drew a lot of attention to the site. In our sense is that the vast majority of the people who read it do actually come from the technology field. They tend to be technologists and such. We have a relatively large audience at this point, and so you get all kinds of people. There's certainly a lot of entrepreneurs and business people who read the site for that sense. Plenty of lawyers, and a growing number of folks, and there's been some dispute among some people as to whether or not we are a legal blog, and there's been some dispute as to whether or not we're a policy blog, and of course we have lots of policy people who follow it, and a reasonable sized following from Washington D.C., which I can't decide if that's good or bad. So it's a mix. And you kind of see that come out in the comments, certainly. And sometimes I think there's some culture clash in the discussions in the comments because you have people coming at it from very, very different perspectives. But, I think that's part of what makes it interesting.
Do you – I did a couple more nuts and bolts questions, I think.
Sure.
I think it's important to understand this primarily, particularly for listeners, because of understanding the sources sources of information on issues which are obscured and that you cover. You are not an attorney. And yet, of course, whether you like it or not, and I suspect you don't, not on a personal level, but just because this is perhaps the one of the problems with technology, IP law, for example, has intruded so heavily into how the Internet operates and its rules and its guiding assumptions. Writing about law as someone that doesn't have formal legal training is certainly not impossible, but could create challenges, or does it? How do you feel about it? And you do have to regularly cover the details of laws.
I mean, it's a good question. It's tricky, but it's one of those things where, you do it a lot, and as we've made clear, we're very, very open to feedback, and so you learn very quickly. I've always been sort of interested in the law in general, and I certainly, back at ILR, took a number of law classes as an undergrad, and so I had a sense on that. But I wouldn't say that prepared me really to write about the law. Mm-hmm. But as you begin to dig into these issues more and more, you learn more and more. And over the years, certainly, I've gotten to know lots of especially IP lawyers and law professors who have been very, very generous at times, actually, in sort of sharing their knowledge with me and information. And so I think over time I've certainly gotten much better at understanding the legal issues and the legal complexities as it relates to IP issues. And again, depending on who you talk to, some people will disagree with that and say that I have no grasp whatsoever of the law, and other people seem to think I have an okay grasp of these issues. But it's a constant learning process, and I think even many legal experts will admit that these things are always about sort of constantly updating your knowledge about things, and so I just sort of try and follow along that way, even if I don't have any official legal training.
Yeah, and you know, and we're chatting with Mike Mazick of Tech Dirt on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Yeah, you know, I mean, Mike, certainly I can appreciate it. Again, reading your reporting regularly as I do, that you know, that people who are representing the entertainment industry would view you as not being fair. But having said that, right? I mean, this is, you know, I think that criticism only goes so far, and I don't think it goes very far, is that, and it's the last thing I want to ask of the structure, is that you back up your claims with links, the modern way of annotating. And the fact of the matter is, and we'll talk about this in a short while, when you have scenarios, as you reported over the last few days, where BMG is sending takedown notices to YouTube involving what seems to be clearly fair uses in copyright law, you know, there may be two sides to the story, but there's one side which seems to clearly have the benefit of the law, at least, and policy, I think, on its side. And so the question of fairness is one in light of the fact that there seems to be a clear position that has merit and one that doesn't. Again, of course, the irony is it depends on what other facts are out there that we may not know about, but based upon what we know, that is a problem. And you cover these issues again. I mean, I'm not, you know, rushing to your defense, and that I should be clear that Mike Mazick or Tech Dirt are not paying me to say any of this. I think these issues do oftentimes break down into one side, particularly on issues like fair use, but there are others, having the better of the argument. I'll ask you this question. I mean, what is, you know, before we move on to substance, what is your direct response when you get told you're not fair to X industry, or I imagine it could be individual, but let's just leave it in industry. What do you say in response? What's your response to that?
I mean, you know, it depends, but the basics are that, you know, I try to be as fair and as factually based as possible, you know, and, you know, one of the arguments is that, you know, and there's a wider debate in journalism over, you know, how do you report different points of view on things, and you know, there is one belief that it is basically you present both sides as if they have equal weighting, and I tend to think that that's not very good reporting. You know, if one thing is true and one thing is not true, I think it's completely fair and reasonable to say this is true and this is not true, even if they are competing viewpoints, and so I think that sometimes when people say I'm not being fair, what they really mean is that they support something that's based on something that is not true or not well supported, might be a little bit more accurate, and therefore that upsets them that I don't give enough credit to an idea that I don't think is particularly well supported. And so, you know, I try to make it clear that here's the assumptions that I'm making, here are the facts that I'm basing what I'm saying on, and I, you know, try and clearly credit that and let people look at it, and you know, we always keep the discussion wide open on TechDirt. We don't require people to even register or log in or anything. People can comment just directly without leaving a name or any identifying information if they like. And so, you know, we encourage widespread conversation. And I've often said, and I, to this day, I believe this, you know, when I post something on TechDirt, it is in many ways the start of a discussion. It is not the final part of the discussion. And so the comments are equally as important to the post. And so I'm expecting people to bring up other facts and other data and help me learn, and help everyone else who's reading learn. So if you think for whatever reason I'm not being fair, I've left out a piece of data or I've presented something out of context, you know, people are free to post that and we can discuss it and learn from it. And I often do learn new and interesting things from it. But, you know, my stance is that, you know, I'm going to give my opinion based on the data and information that I have. And then we can have a discussion about it.
Well, let's do this, Mike. And I think I'll do my public service announcement a little bit earlier than I normally do, because I want to get into substance after the break. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue listening to the show and to the station. Let's jump right in, Mike, on one issue that I think Tech Dirt has covered exceptionally well and that gets very little attention. So it gets almost no attention in traditional, mainstream, whatever phrase you want to use, media, and that you have covered quite well, and I think it's a critical issue, which is the issue of the procedures and processes and administrative law, really, around the creation of IP and technology law, which continues to be a problem. And perhaps I'll ask you that broad question. In your perspective, from this procedural angle, what is the issues, or what are the issues that you're concerned about in the creation of IP and tech law and policy?
It's a really good question. I think that historically, if you look back, IP law and policy had been for many, many years sort of a very narrowly focused topic that really only impacted a few companies, and really, indirectly certainly may have impacted the public, but not in a very direct or major way. And so there wasn't much concern or discussion about those things. And because of that, what you ended up having was a situation where most of those policies and rules are sort of, written in back rooms and sort of, passed along without much fanfare. And there's an issue of revolving doors where, people who are, making the policy, or approving the policy, often come from industry and then go back to industry after, they're in a public service position. And so, you had a very, very one-sided view of all these things, and it was, I wouldn't say, directly corrupt or overtly involving back-scratching, but that was the sort of end result, which was you only really had sort of one viewpoint, and so you would write a law or write a policy or get a treaty passed without, really any public scrutiny or any real analysis on what the impact is on the wider public, even though, especially if we're talking about copyright and patent law, the very basis of both of those is supposed to be what benefits the public the most, the progress of science and the useful arts, if we're talking about the U.S. in particular. And yet, nobody ever seems to step back and say, does this policy benefit the public? There's, you can make the cases that it benefits a certain subset of an industry, and that industry, I think, would argue that therefore, if they are benefited, that it'll benefit the public. But that never, the overall analysis of does this benefit the public never comes out. And so, historically, that's always been the way it's done: is the industry needs something, and then something is sort of done quietly and passed quietly without much fanfare, and then suddenly we have changes to. Especially true for copyright law. Patent law has been a little different. And you would have these changes. And if you look at copyright law in the last, 30 years, there have been changes, sometimes substantial changes to copyright law every year or 2 years. And almost all of that happened without anyone really paying attention. And yet, in large part thanks to the internet, as we've discovered, these things now impact the public very, very directly, and in very, very serious ways at times, and they've had effectively no say in the matter until very recently. The SOPA-PIPA fight suddenly seems to have established that the public has an interest in these things to some extent. And so, but I think everyone who's been involved in policymaking around those issues for decades is so used to just, this is the way it's done. We write a bill. Or often, in some cases, perhaps lobbyists for the industry hand us, legislative text
right.
that we turn into a bill. We put it out, it goes through the approval process very, very quickly, it gets voted on, maybe gets added to a larger bill. Nobody really pays much attention to it, and then it's law. I think that has led to just a massive expansion of of both what copyright law is and what it covers and how it's used. And in very many ways it's been detrimental to the public who it's supposed to benefit.
Now, if that's the case, and you know, sadly, I think that pretty much describes what's been going on. You know, we can take as a touchstone example of this, and it really is, you know, today's example almost. You know, again, the show is airing on Wednesday, or being recorded Wednesday, July 18th. By the time the show airs on Tuesday, July 24th, there may be something else, but you have written just in the last couple of days about something called IP attachés. And I will tell you, I wasn't familiar with the term, frankly, much. I think I may have vaguely passed on it, but here's a perfect example of this under the radar, purposeful perhaps, under the radar lawmaking in IP. And again, this is just one example, but I think it's a useful one for purposes of discussing the process issue. What's an IP attaché, and what's the history of this idea?
Sure. So an IP attaché is a part of the diplomatic corps, and basically they are, you know, people who are, you know, employed by the U.S. government who are tasked to effectively go around the world and promote the U.S. government's view on intellectual property enforcement. So generally speaking, they are pushing other countries to pass laws that are much stricter, that, you know, either extend the length of copyright, increase the amount of enforcement on copyright, or, you know, basically pressuring other countries to put in place a copyright regime that is, really what Hollywood and the big record labels are interested in. They tend not to pay any attention to things like limitations and exceptions in copyright law, things that are important, things like fair use and public domain. Those are not part of the IP attaché's mandate for the most part. And so, you know, to some extent you can look at it and say that it is an attempt by the U.S. to push one particular view of copyright law on other countries and put a lot of pressure on them to change their own laws and policies to reflect what is in the best interest of certain U.S. industries.
And so let me, this may be a question for which there isn't a clear answer, or you may not even know, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So what authority does the government, I'll just put it generally, have to create IP attachés?
The general argument, I think, is that this is, you know, they are diplomats who are tasked with, right, you know, promoting the U.S. interests, U.S.'s mm-hmm. interests on, as part of the Commerce Department.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question as to whether or not they're really promoting the U.S. best interests, or if they're promoting a very small sub-segment of a particular industry's interests. And so you definitely have this role, the IP attaché, that is subject to a form of regulatory capture. And certainly that group of folks has shown that for the most part they are very interested in, focusing on expansion of copyright law, and not any of the concerns about it. There was a story that we had actually a few years ago about a gathering of all the IP attachés. This was in, I think, 2009, in which they held a session where they were effectively complaining about people who were fighting for, copyright reform or more balanced copyright, because they were getting in the way of these diplomats being able to do their job, which is to push for the other direction.
Right.
And I thought that was really kind of quite stunning, because, you know, the U.S. government should be focused on what is most effective in IP law, not what is most favored by one particular industry.
Well, and this gets to this issue, this procedural issue of the public's lack of knowledge. And again, this is a topic I've covered a bit on Hearsay Culture, but I do want to take it at the top level for those who are just, you know, hearing about this issue for the first time. What is the state of transparency and accountability, using those loose terms, first at the international level, and then at the domestic level, in terms of not only IP law and policymaking, but technology law and policymaking?
Yeah, it's really terrible. And you can get into all sorts of details. But certainly, you know, if we're talking about the international level, there's the international trade agreement process, which is just a complete disaster. There's almost no transparency involved. And so, you know, there have been a couple of processes that have gotten a lot of attention lately, within certain circles, certainly. ACTA being the big one. That was, you know, a trade agreement that was supposed to be focused on IP enforcement issues. And there was the U.S. negotiators, which is the U.S. trade representative, USTR, you know, provided no transparency. There were leaks in terms of what they were promoting and what they were negotiating over and what they were proposing, but no official transparency on things. They wouldn't share the documents directly until it was really final, when they finally would release what the document was. And that's a real problem, in that, you know, the USTR in particular is very heavily influenced by industry. They have these, advisory councils, which are often, you know, industry folks and industry lobbyists who have a very particular point of view, and yet they don't seem to take into account the public interest or consumer rights groups or human interest or human rights groups, and so you have this situation. And this is, you know, this is a very, very well known process by which you know, Hollywood and the recording industry has used for many years, which is the international trade agreements. Because, you know, if you think that you can sneak things through Congress easily, it's even easier. Nobody is paying attention to what's happening in international treaties for the most part. And so, you know, you have these diplomats go off to some far-flung country, negotiate some sort of treaty that says that every country that agrees to this particular treaty has to have, you know, X in their copyright law. You know, copyright has to be this long, or it has to cover this, or enforcement has to do this. And then what you have is this wonderful thing, because then you can force the governments to have to change their laws to match that, even though it's basically the same people pushing for it. So you get an international treaty agreed to that says you have to do X, and then you start screaming about how our international obligations require us to change copyright law for this. So even if people say, well, that's not good for us, you say, well, you know, it's too bad. We are, you know, obligated by this treaty to do so. So they play this game where they bounce back and forth, and they try and pass laws locally in different countries, and they're working the treaty process at the same time, and then claiming they have to harmonize different things. And so it becomes you have this way of setting up these ratchets where you're always, you know, ratcheting the law up. You know, copyright law in the U.S. especially has only gone in one direction. You know, basically throughout its history, there are very, very few exceptions of copyright law being pushed back in any way. And a lot of it is because you just have this process by which, you know, treaties are negotiated internationally with no transparency whatsoever, done almost entirely in secret. And then you're effectively locking in the governments of the countries that agree to that treaty to pass laws that, you know, that favor these industries. It's a really nasty process. So the more you look at it, the worse it seems.
We're chatting with Mike Mazick of TechDirt on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, you know, Mike, I'll ask you. So as compared to, the international process, is the domestic lawmaking process on technology and IP any better?
Only very, very, very slightly. It's really not much better, but, you know, I mean, I would just say the international process is so bad, and so opaque and so lacking in transparency that even just marginal bits of transparency is a step forward. Mm-hmm. And so you have a slightly better situation in that, you know, with domestic lawmaking, you know, at least the law does have to be put forth publicly before it's agreed to. But as we've seen with the you know, there are ways to sort of get around that, and that's the big example with the IP Attaché Act, was that it was announced that there was going to be a markup, which, you know, is sort of a technical process in terms of, but it is the process of moving the bill forward so that it can go to the full floor for a vote. And it was announced before the bill was actually released, which is rare. It happens, but it was rare. It's definitely a way to sort of rush through the bill without public scrutiny. And that's what we had happen. You know, thankfully there was a bit of an outcry. So it seems to have been, held back for a little while. It's not entirely clear where that bill is going or what's happening, but it still hasn't been introduced. So there still hasn't been, at the time that we're recording this, there hasn't been real public scrutiny, other than an early draft that was, you know, what was originally going to go through the markup process. And so it's, you know, and this was the same problem with SOPA and PIPA, which was that it was a backroom agreement. And we knew with PIPA, which came out in the Senate, that there was going to be a House companion to it. And lots of people, tried to contact representatives in Congress and explain their concerns with what PIPA was. And in fact, representatives in Congress had been clear that they claimed, Representative Bob Goodlatte, who's very influential on these things, had come to Silicon Valley and actually, held a roundtable session where he told people in Silicon Valley that he heard their concerns and that the House version of PIPA would take into account their concerns. And then SOPA came out and it was the exact opposite. It went even further in the areas of ridiculousness. And talking to people in the tech industry, they said at no point were they invited to the table, at no point were they asked their opinion. And certainly the public was left out entirely as well until after the bill was there. And that's a real concern, and that was a lot of the concern about SOPA. And I know that many of the SOPA supporters complained that about the particular language in the bill. Oh, it's not that bad. But a lot of the complaint wasn't necessarily even just about the substance of the bill, but about the mm-hmm. process by which it came out of a backroom negotiation, which was effectively the entertainment industry and some congressional reps and some congressional staffers with no input from the public, no input from the tech industry. And so you get a very, very one-sided bill, and that's what people were concerned about. And they don't like that process on something that is going to impact their daily lives. That's not a way that, representative democracy should work.
We're chatting with Mike Mazick of Tech Dirt on KZCF from Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Mike, we have about 10 minutes left, and so unfortunately time is running short, and this is what I call the unfair questions portion of the interview, where I ask questions that you can't answer adequately, perhaps in the 10 minutes we have left, and then I ask them anyway. Let me do this follow-up question with you. So, yeah, and so only because of air schedule, it's a little squirrely, but I've interviewed Baron Soka from Tech Freedom. His show is actually going to air primarily because of issues of timeliness a week after yours, but in order to perhaps seed listeners for that interview, I don't normally do this, but I will. Baron had an interesting observation about tech policy broadly, and what he said was that he feels that copyright in particular has gotten far more attention than perhaps it deserves on the tech policy side, and that there are other issues which are like privacy, for example, which he believes are at least as important and are not getting that attention. And I'm curious to get your perspective on that. And by attention, he's referring to scholarship, but more generally, what's your response or view on that critique? Do you agree? Do you disagree? What would be your take on it?
It's a good question, and I think there are a lot of issues that influence a lot that impact a lot of people, and certainly copyright is one, privacy is another, and there are a few others out there certainly, but I'm not sure that there's much to be gained from arguing over which one gets more attention and whether or not that's fair or not.
Well, let me direct the question a little more specifically. With regard to policymaking and lawmaking, yep. we talk a lot about copyright in the sense, at least that, and I, and from Baron's perspective certainly, but I get the sense too that to the extent that there is discussion of technology issues, copyright seems to be a dominant area. And I guess that's really, the question in a nutshell. Do you agree that copyright is getting inordinate attention from policymakers, where other areas are being neglected?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely true. When you look at it, You know, if you look at it from the lawmakers' perspective, the policymaking perspective, that's absolutely true. I mean, you look at just how often copyright law is changed, or you know, there are new bills that amend copyright law in some way or another. It happens all the time. But if you look at privacy law, which is, you know, one of the issues that Barron is you know, intently focused on these days, you know, we have ECPA, which you know, and we have the Fourth Amendment, and you know, ECPA hasn't been updated in decades, and that's, you know, that's
the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, for those that are
Sorry,
it's okay. No, that's my job. Yeah, go ahead.
and it's a big deal, and it's clearly out of date, and it's clearly causing all sorts of problems, and it's just one of those things that Congress just doesn't seem that interested in dealing with, and you know. You could get into a whole other hour or probably 2 or 3 hours worth of discussion as to why that happens and whether or not perhaps some of this is driven by particular special interests who, you know, have a lot more interest than others. And there's probably something to that. But, you know, it's, you know, for whatever it's worth, you know, copyright is something that gets a lot of attention. It's gotten a lot of attention from lawmakers for a while. It hasn't gotten much attention from the public until very recently. And so now it seems even, you know, more in the public eye, because it suddenly got a lot of attention from the public. But after, you know, that came after many years in which, you know, you couldn't get any attention for copyright issues whatsoever. And you had, you know, other bills that in some cases may have been worse than SOPA, I think, that came along and were passed without much public scrutiny, just because the public just didn't care about them. But, you know, now suddenly it is getting more interest because it impacts them more directly. And so I think that, you know, something like privacy, which is becoming more of an issue that impacts people directly, the public will begin to get more and more engaged on it. And so as that happens, you know, and we're already seeing, you know, some effort from policymakers to take privacy issues more seriously, you know, I think those will start to get some more attention, but, you know, maybe not to the level of copyright, because again, the special interest side of it, meaning the sort of the lobbyist involvement, may not be as direct.
So for in the remaining 5-6 minutes that we have, I'll ask you that classic question, which I would be remiss in not asking, given the level of detail and coverage that you have at TechDirt. Perhaps you could outline for my listeners two or three issues that you think are off the radar screen, not just of policymakers, but of people that are interested in technology issues, and what those issues are and your coverage of them.
I mean, there's a lot of different issues that I think are still really important. You know, even though copyright has become something that's gotten a lot of attention, I think that, there, things that are still off the radar include, existing copyright law, that has created problems. And, you know, so for example, you know, the last major change to copyright law was the Pro-IP Act in 2008. And that made some really significant changes that actually put in place a lot of the things that people thought were in SOPA, but was actually in Pro-IP and is already part of law. And we've seen some really negative impacts of that, with things like, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, seizing websites. With very, very little basis, and which seems like, you know, a pure case of censorship and a pure First Amendment issue, where they're literally going in and shutting down blogs, and in one case, you know, holding a blog hostage effectively for over a year without filing any charges whatsoever, not allowing the site to go into court, all sorts of horrible things that really should, I think, should have gotten a lot more attention and should raise questions about that law and whether or not it was legal and whether or not or was constitutional and whether or not it should have been allowed. So I think that, and yet even with SOPA, that issue hasn't gotten much attention. So I think that's there. I think another really big issue is patents within the tech industry. You know, we had the American Invents Act from last year, which very, very marginally touched on some of the issues with patents, but really didn't touch the major issues with in the technology industry, where we have patent trolling and we have patent thickets and just a massive problem that has really, really hindered the ability of lots of services to build up a useful service and compete, because they're going to get hit by a massively expensive patent infringement lawsuit, not because they copied something that someone else did, but because they did, they provided a good service that was a natural extension of where the technology was going, and yet because someone got a patent on something very vague a few years ago that might sort of kind of apply to what this company is doing, they get hit by a patent infringement lawsuit. And it's become a really, really massive problem in the tech industry, and I think really deserves a lot more attention than hasn't gotten it. Those are probably the two big ones. There's more, but I'm talking too much already.
Well, no, you're not. I was about to stop you, but you're not talking too much yet. Let me ask you this follow-up question before we close. And this is aimed directly at many listeners of Hearsay Culture who are indeed professors. If you were addressing a room full of technology IP professors saying, this is how you could contribute to our discussions, what kind of scholarship would you like to see, if any, coming from professors that focus on these issues?
Sure. Well, I should say, first of all, there actually has been a lot of really good academic research that's been coming out lately that tries to dig into these issues. And the key thing is really just having more data and more factual evidence of what happens, because so much of IP law in particular is based on purely on theory. That, and that theory is often IP is good, more IP is better. and that is, theory without much evidence to support it. And in fact, there's an increasing amount of evidence that suggests that, that's not a supportable claim. And yet the policy making has always been based on that. So more research and more data and more evidence that shows what is a reasonable IP policy, and when you increase IP laws, what happens? When you decrease IP laws, what happens? The more that we can, the more real data and factual basis that can be injected into the debate, the more likely it is that we get good results as opposed to crazy results.
Mike Maznick, the founder and journalist, if you will, on TechDirt. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. Again, you can read TechDirt at techdirt.com. And thank you for joining us on the show. Appreciate it. I absolutely invite you back, because there are any number of topics we could have covered today. Indeed, there were several topics I would hope to have covered, but didn't. Thank you for being here today. Please keep up the great work that you do, and I'll look forward to chatting with you again in the future.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
I'm happy to mention a number of guests coming up for the remaining time on the summer quarter on KZSU's schedule for Hearsay Culture. As I mentioned, next week, Baron Zoka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the terrific book of essays, The Next Digital Decade. Following that interview, Professor Madhavi Sundar of UC Davis School of Law, author of From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice. Marcin D. Kaminski and Stefan Larsson of Lund University in Sweden, Pirate Bay and their work, studying Pirate Bay in Sweden. Professor Woodrow Hartzog of Cumberland School of Law at Samford, and Fred Stutzman of UNC on privacy and social media. Professor Chris Sprigman of Virginia Law, co-author of the new book, The Knockoff Economy. And rounding out the quarter, Professors Jeremy DeBeer and Chidi Ogomanam of the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law, discussing the Open Air Project. I'm also excited to mention some guests that are coming up down the road in the fall or perhaps winter quarters on KZSU and Hearsay Culture. Dr. Deborah Peel on health information privacy. Professor Julie Cohen will be returning from Georgetown Law, author of the book Configuring the Network Self. Professor Patrick Lynn of California Polytechnic State University on the ethics and philosophy behind technology. And Professor Ann Balsamo of USC Annenberg School of Communication, author of the recent book Designing Culture to Technological Imagination at Work. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen Madison this quarter, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. Pacific time on KZSU Stanford. You can stream the show live at kzsulive.stanford.edu if you're not in the Bay Area at that time. Or you can get the show via podcast, via a couple of ways, hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 160-odd shows as well as the upcoming schedule, or by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or our Apple page, where you'll get not only Hearsay Culture, but also any other events occurring at Stanford. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, thank you for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.